Mr. Redmond.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Wesley Redmond, and I represent the appellant All Points Logistics in this case. I'm going to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. All Points is a government contractor, and this case involves a dispute between All Points and a former employee, Doug Killo, and a company he formed. Killo claims breach of contracts, including an alleged oral agreement for All Points to novate or give away to him millions of dollars worth of government contracts. I think it's important for the court to know these are national security contracts, missile defense contracts, important contracts. All Points also asserted various counterclaims against Killo and his company. Our arguments here today and our appeal focuses primarily on the unreliability of the jury verdict, which we believe requires a reversal. And the verdict is unreliable because we believe the jury was confused and that the errors committed by the court led to the confusion. For instance, the court rejected All Points' verdict form, which would have clarified the issues for the jury or prevented the confusion on appeal, but also were improper comments by counsel made during closing, which we believe further confused the jury. The multiple errors that we think led to a compromised verdict and the cumulative impact of all the errors are grounds for reversal and at least a new trial, if not an instruction that the trial court should dismiss plaintiff's claims. I'd first like to address that the jury verdict was an impermissible compromise verdict. The jury's finding of liability on All Points' claims, but no damages, and the jury's inexplicable verdict for damages for the plaintiff that cannot be calculated and appears simply to be picked out of a hat, has all the elements of a compromise verdict, where the facts and circumstances demonstrate the jury was unable to reach an agreement on liability.
When I look at our precedents about compromise verdicts, we've said that jurors reach an unlawful compromise, right, when they resolve their inability to make a determination with any certainty on the issue of liability by finding inadequate damages. I don't think that's the argument exactly here. But then when we look to it, we look at the totality of the circumstances, including whether there was highly contested liability, evidence of prior deadlock, or some inconsistency in the verdict. And I'm having a hard time understanding how that's what happened here. Can you address that?
Certainly, Your Honor. First, I would like to address the issue about the inadequate damages. The beginning of this argument does begin with inadequate damages on All Points' counterclaims. We were not just a defendant in this case. We also had counterclaims where the jury first found liability but no damages, although there was evidence. Mr. Killo even admitted that he took and used All Points' trade secrets. There was evidence of millions of dollars of losses. And so we think there is that issue. But more importantly, the jury found there was a breach of contract, which an element of a breach of contract is damages, but they awarded no damages, not even nominal damages. But we also believe one of the things the court should look at is the verdict that was rendered for the plaintiff. And I used the term earlier that it appeared to be picked out of a hat because that's what this court said in U.S. v. Sullivan. When looking at a compromise verdict, there needs to be some rational basis for it. But on the other issues, on the highly contested case, I would say not only is highly contested, this case was hotly contested. The court admitted to it. All Points has...
Jury never indicated it was deadlocked, though, on liability, did it?
It did not, but the jury did ask. The jury did make a request to see Ms. Gardner's expert damage report and her testimony. We think it was so they could find out.
That was within the first hours of deliberation, right?
Yes, and they also asked.
Which suggests that they were already considered the damages question early on, right?
Or it equally suggests that they were looking to see if there was a damage number that they could live with because they couldn't reach agreement as to liability.
I mean, why would we infer that they were deadlocked?
The reason that I would infer that is the other bit of evidence they asked for at the same time was the testimony of Mr. Saris, who was Mr. Kilo's partner. His testimony was the one that was about that there was no specific terms reached during these discussions where the idea of novation was thrown out. But we also know that the jury was out for more than a day. It began deliberations on a Friday, deliberated through Friday, all day Monday, came in at 5 o'clock Monday night. We think all of that indicates that this is a compromise verdict. But the court also has to look at the fact that the amount awarded by to the plaintiff had no relation to the evidence.
Wasn't it within the range of numbers that were discussed? I realize that maybe you can't recreate exactly what the jury did, but wasn't it within the range of damages numbers that was within the evidence that was presented to the jury?
It is only within the range of numbers if you look at the range of numbers as being zero and the $4.2 million the plaintiff was asking for. It's not like in U.S. versus Sullivan where the defendant said the damages should be $5,000 and the plaintiff said it should be
$100,000. I thought the novation claim, the request was $3.4 million.
Yes, but they asked the jury for $4.2 million. Part of what we believe led to this problem was plaintiff's counsel asking for one sum and plaintiff's expert using one sum. So we believe there is sufficient indication of, but one of the main things we think the court should look at, and we believe this also is a separate error, all points tried to prevent this from happening. We tried to get the court to separate out the three contracts so we could avoid this, but the court refused to do this. We have to remember, plaintiff's breach of contract claim sought relief on three separate contracts, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, Teledyne Brown. But plaintiffs sought damages on all three together, including another unrelated claim. We think they should have been treated separately. These are different contracts, different decision makers, different transactions, different subject matters.
The point about the verdict form is so brief in your brief and so sparse in terms of authority that would allow us to reverse a jury finding on that, Mr. Redmond, that I'm not sure that it even qualifies as an argument. I mean, what authority do you have that a verdict form, that the denial of your verdict form request would be a basis for reversing a jury trial finding of this kind?
Your Honor, in our standard of review, we pointed out some cases that talked about that if it's confusing and misleading to the jury, it could be grounds for a new trial.
I don't know what's confusing about this, just because they didn't do, there's no real explanation of how this was confusing.
Well, we say it's confusing because it confused the jury to think that they needed to treat all three of them as one, because that's how it was presented to them. And again, this is what we tried to prevent. We also had an issue with counsel's
having general verdicts with aggregate findings is not unusual in district courts, now, is it?
No, Your Honor, it is not. But these circumstances are particularly called for it because of the difference between the three contracts. They're three different subject matter. Briefly, I would talk about also counsel's comment also helped contribute to this because counsel instructed the jury, do not award even nominal damages, because if you do, it's going to open up their award of attorney's fees. We think that's contrary to the instructions of the court. But part of the reason why this is so hotly contested, there was a fundamental issue in that there was no evidence and agreement to novate or give away the government contracts. This whole claim was based on an idea that supposedly was thrown out during negotiations, in which plaintiff's own witness said, we didn't reach any terms there. Contracts must be definite and definite enough for the courts to know what it means. As this court said in Baldwin County versus Purcell Corporation, 971 F. 2nd, 1558, the mutual assent of the parties to the same thing in the same sense.
You know, here's the thing. As I understand it, Mr. Kello testified, right, that was the agreement, to novate the contracts. And he testified that the complete transfer was non-negotiable, that the from the start, and he presented emails with Moncris to that effect. Isn't that right?
Well, Your Honor, first, the things he wanted, that was his testimony about what he wanted. There was never testimony that was the agreement. The testimony was Mr. Moncris threw out the idea of a novation when it appeared they couldn't subcontract.
I'm quoting from his testimony. Transferring the contracts via novation was the agreement. He testified to that.
But it's not based on any facts other than his conclusion there, because the facts were that novation simply was thrown out.
Well, but so. I mean, they had a conversation, which you don't want to acknowledge as an agreement. Three conditions that were understood, at least. And it does look like all points complied with some of those conditions, and that Mr. Kilo then continued to engage in a business arrangement with all points with that understanding. And then they went back and forth several times to distill the oral agreement or understanding in writing. And that is where the challenge, I think, presents itself and why you have a case. So I also find it very difficult to conclude that there was not an oral agreement or at least a legitimate basis for Mr. Kilo's understanding that all three conditions would eventually be satisfied. Where in the record can you point me to undermine that otherwise conclusion?
His testimony that the only time novation was mentioned was when it was thrown out.
Well, I thought there was evidence, though, that Boeing representative testified that Boeing corporate policy required a shift from subcontracting to novation, which would corroborate his testimony.
That was Mr. Kilo's testimony. Boeing's testimony was, number one, their testimony was they would be shocked if they'd ever heard from all points that they wanted to give away their contracts. But they said, we don't even allow subcontracts of more than 40% of this. So there was no way.
You're telling me the Boeing representative did not testify that Boeing corporate policy required a shift from subcontracting to novation?
No. There was not testimony from the Boeing representative that, and All Points has denied that. They have denied that had to be shifted because of anything that occurred with All Points.
So all of the discussion or colloquy that's in the record on that particular point is just somehow fabricated, or, I mean, how do you explain that?
Yes.
As
yes.
Fabricated.
Yes. We believe it simply is not accurate. All Points has denied.
Of course, the jury believed it.
Yeah, All Points has denied from the beginning that it ever did or ever would have.
But the problem for you is that Mr. Killaw testified that your client did agree to novation, and the jury had the right to believe that. If the jury, I mean, is there some reason why the jury couldn't believe that I'm missing here?
Well, because even with that testimony, there are so many essential terms missing that it can't be an enforceable contract.
None of which you identified in your Rule 50A motion.
But we did identify that we thought that there was not an enforceable contract. The law of this circuit has been,
well,
once you identified an issue.
But this material terms point that you've asserted on appeal was not something that you raised in that motion.
But we did raise that there was not an enforceable agreement, and we enforced several grounds, and we think the law of the circuit, which we've cited in our brief, allows us to raise these arguments now that we have not waived those.
All right, Mr. Redmond, you've gone over a bit,
yes.
But you'll save 3 minutes. Let's hear from Mr. Driver.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Chris Driver on behalf of the appellees, Doug Kilo and his company, TCS. This is a kitchen sink appeal following a 10-day trial that resulted in a jury verdict, and I believe that jury verdict is the most important issue here, is because, first, there was discussion about the evidence and the contract and whether there's an oral agreement. There was sufficient evidence of an agreement here.
Will you tell me about the Boeing representative and what that testimony was? Have I got that right or wrong?
You're directionally correct. But the testimony from the Boeing representative was They do not allow a subcontractor to then have a subcontractor below that send out more than 40% of its work. They didn't say Novation necessarily had to follow. They said, if our subcontractor is going to subcontract more than 40% of the work, we're not going to allow that. But I believe that's important context here because it provides context for why Mr. Munkris raised the issue of Novation.
It would corroborate the idea, though, that you wouldn't have that problem if you novated the contract.
Correct, Your Honor, because again, they originally did discuss subcontracting, but when this wrinkle popped up, they had to switch and move to Novation. And so I believe that that evidence, along with Mr. Killo's testimony, where he said that Mr. Munker said, let's do it, Mr. Killo then said, okay, I think that's a meeting of the minds, that's an offer, that's acceptance. Lay people do not have to speak like us lawyers and phrase it offer and acceptance.
Can you tell me more about the compromise verdict argument?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it's key here that there does have to be inadequate damages. And importantly, the appellant is not...
He says inadequate on the part of the counterclaim.
Correct, Your Honor. So importantly, they were asking for actual damages here. And so there had to be proof of causation that anything Mr. Killo did caused harm to APL. And in their briefing, they raised two issues. The first is attorney's fees, that they incurred attorney's fees because of breach of contract or their trade secrets claims. But there was no evidence of actual amounts of attorney's fees here. The trial court bifurcated the issue of attorney's fees because for the contract claim, that would be a jury issue. And so to make the trial more efficient, APL moved to bifurcate that issue. And so attorney's fees was not even an issue in this part of the trial.
What about his point that there were no nominal damages awarded?
So, Your Honor, they have not raised as an error in this case that the failure to award nominal damages somehow affected the jury verdict. But actually, I do think the law on nominal damages is somewhat instructive here because those are awarded when there's a insufficient proof of actual damages. And I believe that's what happened here, especially with the breach of contract. Perhaps the jury did find that maybe there was a breach of contract, but insufficient proof of an actual amount of damages to award. And I think that's important in the compromise verdict context because inadequate damages is required. And in fact, Judge Kahlon in the trial court away from the jury said that he would have taken away any verdict that was awarded to APL or any damages award given to APL because of the insufficient proof of damages here. APL primarily pointed to a Northrop Grumman contract that Mr. Killo received after he left APL, but there was testimony from a Northrop Grumman representative saying that APL could not perform that contract. And so there's a lack of but-for causation there, that if APL could not perform that contract, then it necessarily could not have, received it but for some action, Mr. Killo. And on the damages issue, this was a complicated case. There were multiple contracts that Mr. Killo was claiming lost profits under. There were time frames. There were projections of future lost profits. There was a net present value calculation. There was prejudgment interest. So this is not a case where, the exact math, I think, is relevant here, is because the jury was within the reasonable range, which Judge Rosenbaum, you pointed out. We asked for a little over $3 million on that component of damages, and we received less than that. I wish we'd received the full amount, but certainly we received less than that. And that was within the range and within the jury's discretion to award that.
Can I turn your attention for a moment to the claim on which summary judgment was granted for you about the breach of contract based on the faithless servant doctrine?
Yes.
All right. So... for that claim, the district court found that there wasn't sufficient notice for making that claim, right?
Correct.
Why is it that the answer that, or the amended answer, I guess it's docket entry 54,
correct,
didn't provide sufficient notice on that?
So, Your Honor, the faithless servant doctrine is both a defense and a flavor of a fiduciary duty claim, and it relates to the injury or the damages aspect of that fiduciary duty claim, or as a defense to a claim for an employee seeking compensation. And the important point here is the factual predicate for that doctrine, that claim, was not pled. So to receive damages under the faithless servant doctrine, which are to claw back compensation from an employee, I believe you'd have to plead that you were suffered an injury and that you continue to pay the faithless employee, or the employee is potentially unjustly enriched by receiving compensation despite the faithlessness. And so I think this goes to the basic Rule 8A pleading standard of you have to have plausible factual allegations to support the legal conclusions. Here there's an unstated legal conclusion, the faithless servant doctrine, but there's also not the factual predicate, the injury of continuing to pay the, quote, faithless employee or the employee continuing to be unjustly enriched. And so I think that's what it goes to, is just the basic pleading standard. But regardless, I believe the error was harmless.
Well, let me ask you. I mean, didn't APL allege that Killaw acted in bad faith and was disloyal as an employee? In other words, that they were paying him. While they were paying him, he was being disloyal. Why isn't that sufficient to show that they were injured by paying him while he was being disloyal, allegedly?
They did allege that he was being disloyal, but they did not allege the injury. They alleged two injuries, one, diminished competitive capacity, and two, continuing to place trust in Mr. Killaw by giving him access to confidential information. And those two injuries do not tie to the faithless servant theory there.
So you're saying they would have had to have alleged that what?
That they continued to pay him and they suffered an injury because of that, or potentially that he was unjustly enriched by receiving that compensation.
Why would they have to say that specifically if they're saying that he was an employee and he was disloyal and acting in bad faith? I mean, why doesn't that sort of imply pretty clearly that he was continuing to be paid and that was the injury?
Well, I think it goes to notice, and you know, there's a broad swath of damages theories you can have for a breach of fiduciary duty, and they just simply did not raise this one. I think notice of the injury, notice for the damages that they are seeking is important here. But regardless, I believe the error was harmless if there was any error there. I believe this court can even apply a harmless error standard to summary judgment rulings. So the verdict form and the jury instructions are very important on this point. On the fiduciary duty claim, they ask three questions. One, did Mr. Killaw owe a fiduciary duty? The jury said yes. Two, did Mr. Killaw breach that fiduciary duty? The jury said no. The third question was on damages. And so there was sufficient, was evidence.
Fair enough, thank you.
Okay, there was evidence presented on that point. And I would like to say Mr. Redmond brought up the verdict form. Again, I don't believe there is anything misleading in the jury form. There certainly was no argument about what was misleading. It does not misstate the law. And so I would say that the jury form was sufficient here. The trial judge had broad discretion under Rule 49 to fashion the verdict form as it pleased. And I'm happy to answer any further questions that the panel has.
Do you have any others?
I don't.
Otherwise, I would simply ask that you affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Driver. Mr. Redmond.
Yes, Your Honors, I appreciate Judge Rosenbaum bringing up the faithless servant, because we think that is one of the most egregious errors that was made here.
Well, let me start then by asking you about what your friend on the other side of the aisle said. And he said, even assuming that it was error to grant the summary judgment, it was harmless error because the jury returned on the verdict form a finding that I guess they found he had a fiduciary duty, but they found that he did not breach his fiduciary duty. Right? Is that right?
Well, yes. Because
So why is that not harmless error then?
Because the judge had instructed the jury that one of the elements of a breach of fiduciary duty claim was damages. So by finding of no damages, they would have found that there was no breach.
Well, it was set out as three separate questions, right? One, did he have a duty? Yes. Two, did he breach the duty? No. Three, were there any damages? Which became a moot question when they said that he didn't breach, right?
But the judge, when they instructed the jury, including damages, much like in the breach of contract claim, as being an actual element of the breach of fiduciary duty. So we think, much as with the contract claim they found that there was a breach but no damages, we believe they probably have made a similar determination here, not wanting to award damages. They did not find a breach. We think it's all tied in together, and we think we should have been able to present that to the jury to show that as damages. I wanted to address Judge Pryor's point about the Boeing testimony, and this shows how nonsensical the idea is that all points would have agreed to give away all of their contracts. If the testimony from Boeing was, we will not allow you to subcontract more than 40%, Boeing would never have allowed, I mean, the inference to be drawn, and I believe the testimony, Boeing never would have, had never allowed someone simply to give away 100% of their contract. If you can't subcontract more than 40%, how can you give away 100% of it? That's why we have denied from the beginning that this idea of a novation and that it was because of anything that occurred with Boeing was the reason for
it. But it would be a subcontractor relationship at that point, right?
At that point, yes, it would have been a subcontractor relationship, which gets back to the novation. And one of the essential problems is none of the elements, none of the essential terms were worked out. What contracts? What's all points going to continue to do? What happens with...
He actually did testify to that, Mr. Redmond. And again, insofar as your complaint is that, a failure as to material terms, that was not the basis of your motion.
And it could also be that perhaps all points never intended to comply with that condition for the reasons you just said in terms of it not making good business sense. But that is the same as Mr. Killo believing that based on what was represented to him and then acting in accordance.
But there's no evidence in the record at all to support. In fact, there was a fraud claim brought that was dismissed because there was no evidence at all to support that all points entered into that agreement with no intention of performing it.
All right, Mr. Redmond.
I see my time is up. Thank you. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. We have your case, and we'll be in recess until tomorrow.